Good morning again, and if you're a guest with us, we want to warmly welcome you, let you know that you've joined us in the middle of a series, a four-week series called Crazy Busy, after the title of a book right here. You can get these books in the bookstore, and I highly recommend them, and so you should stop by the bookstore after the service and pick one up. We began this series last week by examining the danger of busyness. You can access that sermon on our website, both the audio and the video version. And this week, I want us to begin by diving into two biblical stories, one from the Old Testament, the book of Daniel, and one from the New Testament in Matthew's Gospel. Daniel is a young Jewish man of noble birth. He was taken from his home in Judah and exiled with other Jews into the kingdom of Babylon. That is where we would today, it is modern day Iraq. He is the prophet who wrote this book. And in Babylon, Daniel was trained and served on the king's court. And the first king that Daniel served was Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled for over 40 years until about the year 562 BC. And as we read the story, God gave Daniel great favor with Nebuchadnezzar so that he was promoted to a ruler over the whole province of Babylon, much like Joseph in Egypt. And we learn a great deal about Daniel and his Jewish friends, about how to remain faithful to God while living in a culture that did not share their faith. But we also learn a great deal about this interesting character, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a man with a serious ego. In chapter 3, we read that he had a 90-by-9-foot golden statue made of himself. And then he ordered everyone in his kingdom to bow down and worship the statue every time they heard the sound of music being played. And anyone who did not bow down was to be put to death. Then in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is walking on the roof of his palace and he's looking out over the city, looking out over his palace grounds, and he says, as Dan read for us, "Is it not this great Babylon which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" And immediately as he says these words, God's judgment comes upon him for his pride, humbling him and rendering him insane so that he lives as a wild animal. Now later, Nebuchadnezzar's reason is returned to him, and God gives him back his kingdom. And at that time, Nebuchadnezzar lifts his eyes towards heaven and exclaims, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just." And then here's the punchline, and this is a theme that runs throughout Scripture. "And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble." So Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson. And perhaps we would say he learned it the hard way. But he ended up giving praise and honor to God. Now let's move to the New Testament, where Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 speaks some of his harshest words. And these words are directed at two groups of people, the scribes and the Pharisees, two distinct groups but related to one another. Now, to put this in the most basic terms, scribes were the professional interpretive experts on the Old Testament law. So their interpretations on the law essentially became, since I'm an accountant, I would call their interpretations became called what I would call the rules and regs of the law. their interpretations explained in great detail how the law was to be kept. And I've mentioned before that the Old Testament law on keeping the Sabbath holy, they had over 24 written volumes on what that meant. So scribes were the experts who wrote the rules. And the Pharisees were people who really prided themselves on keeping those rules. That was their identity. They were the ones who kept the rules. The Pharisees, and again, it's much more complicated than that, but that's just a basic way of understanding who these people were. The Pharisees were especially scrupulous to maintain a righteous standing before God. And so many were like the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul had been a Pharisee before he became a Christian. And Paul, as a Pharisee, claimed that he was blameless as to the law. In other words, all those rules and regs about the Sabbath, Paul's saying, yeah, I kept all those. And this is why Paul says that as a Pharisee, he had a righteousness, or in other words, he had a rightness before God of his own that came from the law. It was his own because it was all based upon what Paul did or didn't do. The Pharisees were meticulous to obey every detail of the rules and regs. They tithed even from their garden herbs. They fasted twice a week. They maintained their ritual purity at meals. And they would never, you know, share fellowship, share the table with sinners. Luke records a parable of Jesus in chapter 18 that perfectly illustrates the mindset of these men. And I say men because they were all men. Women were not allowed. So here's Luke 18. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves, that's kind of what Paul is talking about, trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. People who were despised. They were the epitome of sinners. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified, or made right with God, rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. We would all do well to learn this parable, to learn this teaching of Jesus. It is very important to understanding what it means to be a follower, to be a disciple of Jesus. And that line that Jesus, you know, the punchline of the parable, it sounds a lot like Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't it? You know, God can bring down those who are prideful. You know, by the way, the Pharisees actually did pray that way. You know, we think that prayer just sounds absurd. No, they really did pray that way. We actually have written prayers where the Pharisees would thank God that they were not born a woman or a Gentile. Now, before we begin to think that pride is only a problem for Pharisees and kings, we need to remember the story that we read about in the garden. The Garden of Eden, Genesis chapter 3, where Adam and Eve committed the original sin, the sin of pride, because they were tempted to want to desire to be like God. You know, God is not interested in sharing his position, in part because it's his and it really suits him, it fits him, you know? But also because he understands that you and I are not very good at being God. And when we try to be God, we actually do a lot of damage to ourselves and to others and to the world around us. The sin of pride is the first, the original sin. And it runs deep in all of us. In many ways, we all want to be our own little gods, running our own little worlds. Patrick, you may be thinking, this is all fine and good. What in the world does your, you know, kind of biblical exploration on pride have to do with busyness? What is the point? Well, here it is. What if at core, the problem of busyness is at least partly self-created? What if the problem of busyness isn't solely caused by the circumstances out there? What if the problem of busyness is also about the problem that we have in here, in our hearts? Kevin DeYoung, the author of the book Crazy Busy, he writes this: the disorder of daily life is a product of disorder in the innermost places of the heart. Things are not the way they ought to be because we are not the way we are supposed to be, which means our understanding of busyness must start with the one sin that begets so many of our other sins, pride. What if the cause of busyness is at least in part due to the sin of pride that actually plagues us all? You know, the challenge that we have at kind of getting at all of this, getting to the root of pride in our hearts, is that on the one hand, pride can be very brash, like Nebuchadnezzar or the Pharisees. You know, that's just pride kind of right in your face. But I think pride can also be very subtle and insidious. You know, DeYoung, I think he has a brilliant line. He describes pride as a villain with 1,000 faces. A villain with 1,000 faces. And so for a few moments, I want to just explore just two of the ways, just two, and I think there are actually many more, but we don't have time to go through them. But I want to explore just two ways that I think pride can inform our busyness. The first is this, and I think this is something that plagues so many of us, me included. People-pleasing. People-pleasing. Now, the most obvious form of pride is where we do things so that we will be praised. You know, so people will give us the proverbial pat on the back. We desire accolades, and so that can drive us to excessive busyness because we want to do as many things as we can so that people will praise us. That's kind of an obvious form of pride, right? However, I suspect that for many of us, the story of our busyness goes something like this, something that's completely different. It would go something like this: I'm busy because I have too much to do. I'm trying to do more than what I have time for. I'm in this predicament because I say yes to too many people. I say yes to too many people because if I say no, I'm afraid they will be disappointed in me and I fear their disapproval. And as counterintuitive as this may seem, that kind of people-pleasing mentality is a form of pride and narcissism. Why? Because it's based upon our desire. We need to be liked. And that stems from pride. We need to be liked. Obviously, being kind and serving is a Christian virtue, right? So we're not attacking being kind and serving. That should be abundantly clear. However, what people can't see, the motivation of our hearts, what people can't see but God can see, is this: are we serving others with kindness toward them as the motivation of our hearts? You know, if we are serving others because we love God and therefore we love others and want to serve them, well, that's one thing. But if we are kindly serving others so that they won't disapprove of us, but rather will love us and feed our ego, that is another thing and not a good thing. So on the outside, we may look like the servant of all because we say yes to every invitation to help. But if we've learned anything from our series that we just completed on the Sermon on the Mount, we should remember that conformity, or looking good on the outside, is not what life in the kingdom of God is based upon. When God's rule comes from heaven to earth, it's something that goes deep into our hearts so that it produces a kingdom motivation. And if our motivation is, however, the fear of being disapproved of rather than our love for God and others, it can make us crazy busy and obviously make us miserable. Now, another way that I think pride kind of feeds into this phenomenon of being crazy busy, having more to do than we're able to do, is what I would call performance evaluation. Performance evaluation. Generally speaking, we as Americans tend to overestimate our performance. That's an established fact. They've done all kinds of studies on this, especially with students. They'll take a bunch of students from the United States and from all over the world, and they'll ask them this very simple question. They all get the same standardized test, and they'll ask all the students, how do you think you did? And what the studies all show is that we, the Americans, always say, we did the best, without exception. We always think we did better than everyone else. This is a fact. And guess what? Our performance is almost always toward the bottom. And interestingly, kids from several different Asian countries always rate themselves at the bottom. And guess how they do? The best. It sounds a little bit like that kind of humility pride thing, doesn't it? That Jesus is talking about. How the humble are exalted and the prideful are brought down, doesn't it? No, maybe Jesus actually knew what he was talking about. Maybe. Maybe he did. So we tend to think that we're better than we are. Now, think about this. If we overestimate our performance, it can contribute to our busyness because we begin to think, if I don't do this, no one else will. Thinking too highly of our own abilities can create the belief that it all depends on us because no one else can do, and you just fill in the blank, whatever it is, no one else can do what I can do as well as I can do it. And perhaps we wouldn't be as busy if we rated our performance a bit more realistically, because then we would not need to be in control. It's one of the reasons why I do not insist upon having to preach every single Sunday. And, you know, I'm more than happy to share the pulpit, because it's a way that, because whenever I do, guess what? The people who fill in get praised. Oh, that was a great sermon that Nick preached, or Ellis preached, or whoever. You know, those were great sermons. And it's a reminder to me, you're not as good as you may think you are. You are not irreplaceable. Because when we start to think that we're better than we are, we start to foolishly think perhaps we are irreplaceable. And the truth is, no one is. And it's like, well, if the Pope is not irreplaceable, I guess I'm not either. You know, it's like one Pope leaves, we get a new one, okay? Things go on. That's just the way the world is. We're not irreplaceable. I don't think there's any doubt that pride drives a great deal of our busyness. But the problem is kind of being able to sort it all out in real life. Because to be sure, the real life applications are much more difficult than just kind of writing them out for a sermon. They're much more complex, okay? You know, if we were to conclude that people pleasing, for example, in our life was a real problem, you know, and I suspect that it is a problem, the solution would not be as simple as just telling everyone who ever asks us to do anything, no, you know, I can't do it because I don't want to fall into people-pleasing. You know, we still have to sort out in some kind of intelligent way what we're going to say yes to and what we're going to say no to, right? So how can we do that in a more deliberate way? Kevin DeYoung suggests a simple diagnostic question that he asks himself that helps him to sort out his motivation. Here's the question. Am I trying to do good or make myself look good? Am I trying to do good or make myself look good? It's a straightforward question. It doesn't make the inherently complex, you know, much more simple, but it's a start. It's a start that helps us to get at what is the motivation in my heart that is driving me. Because if we can begin to answer that question honestly, we can start to unravel those motivations. Think about it. You get asked to do something, something that's good, something that will bless other people. You know that your schedule is full, and that if you say yes, it's gonna push you over the edge. You can't just say no as an automatic response. It seems Jesus had some very clear teaching about that. You might want to read the parable of the Good Samaritan. You can't just say, no, I can't be inconvenient, so no. But on the other hand, you can't just automatically say yes, because then your life can just spin out of control and you can be crazy busy. Hopefully, as Christ followers, our default position is the desire to serve others, which would typically lead us to say yes to invitations to serve. But before we do, perhaps we should ask ourselves the question, am I saying yes to serve God and others, or am I saying yes to serve my own desire, not to disappoint the person making the request? You know, saying yes always looks good on the outside. But as we've said, kingdom life is about much more than that. Jesus, who is our King, sees and cares deeply about the motivations of our hearts. So if we wrestle with that question, it helps us to sort out our motives. In the book, DeYoung writes, it's okay to be busy at times. You can't love and serve others without giving of your time. So work hard. Work long, work often. Just remember, it's not supposed to be about you. Feed people, not your pride. Now, in addition, I want to suggest something of a different sort that I think will help us keep our pride in check. This might even be simpler and gets at the core, I think, really of our problem. We need to stay rooted, or we need to stay grounded in the gospel, because the good news of the gospel helps us to stay humble before God. Why? Well, just listen to what the good news of the gospel is. Here are some of Paul's words from 1 Corinthians 15. He writes, "Now let me remind you, dear brothers and sisters, of the good news I preached to you. For your faith is built on this wonderful message. And it is this good news that saves you if you firmly believe it. I passed on to you what was most important and what had also been passed on to me, that Christ died for our sins just as the Scriptures said. He was buried and he was raised from the dead on the third day, as the Scriptures said. He was seen by Peter, by the 12 apostles, by more than 500 of his followers at one time. Then he was seen by James and by all the apostles. Last of all, I saw him too, long after the others, as though I had been born at the wrong time. For I am the least of all the apostles, and I am not worthy to be called an apostle after the way I persecuted the church of God. But whatever I am now, it is all because God poured out his special favor, grace, on me, and not without results. For I have worked harder than all the other apostles. Yet it was not I, but God who was working through me by his grace." Now, you don't need to be a biblical scholar to understand that the clear emphasis of the good news of Jesus is about him and what he has done. So when we say, it's not about you and me, you know, that's not just like an advertising tagline. It's actually true. It's not primarily about you or me. It's about Jesus and what he has done for us. Even the effort that we put forth to love and serve others is not about us, Paul would say. It's an evidence of God's grace at work in us. When we stay grounded in that gospel, in that good news, it enables us to stay humble before God and others. Because our pride is leveled at the cross. Because the cross is a stark reminder that you and I haven't brought much to this party. Jesus is the one who has. The cross of Christ is the antidote to all human pride. We sing, "Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe." That's the message. And we are invited to believe, to put our trust in him. And as that reality settles deep into our hearts and minds, it has a way of sorting things out. Our pride, our busyness, and everything else for that matter. You know, this is why we place an emphasis on coming to the Lord's table and our worship. We do it, you know, we don't do this because it's just a neat tradition. And we don't do this because Anglicans are supposed to. That's not why Anglicans gather at the table week by week in worship. No. Anglicans come to the table week after week because when we come, it roots us in the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel that we have received, and now, like Paul, we commit ourselves to passing on to others.